Session number 9278.
Mr. Cotman, Reel 5. So what was the chap's response when he said that to him?
So he said, yes, all right, I do need some money, and he agreed that the money wasn't due to him. He was really seeking more.
And when Orwell told the Spaniard off about the dog, did he get the Spaniard to do what he wanted?
Oh, yes. Yes, he did it without any resentment. I think the Spaniard sensed that he was well-wishing, that he meant well, and the Spaniard responded in that way, you see. He did have a thing about treatment of animals, George Orwell, like a lot of English people do have. He deplored, for example, the way the Spanish people at the front treated their horses. They drove them quite unnecessarily up and down a particular stretch for hours, as though, you know, horse racing style. And at the end of it, they would, you'd see the steam coming off the flanks. And it isn't as though they were delivering messages or that there was anything of any point about this other than just driving the horse and seeing how fast it can go and how long it could keep it up.
Did he intervene over that?
No, I don't think he did. I think that he realised that this was an organised thing, and he didn't intervene directly with the people riding the horses. But I understand that he did take it up with Bob Edwards and George Kopp, that this wasn't desirable to do it, and that people capable of giving the right orders ought to stop it.
Was he a scruffy man, or was he neat and tidy?
Oh, pretty tidy, really. I have to be careful in answering this, because we nearly all look scruffy anyway, you see. And when I met him in life back in England after the Spanish thing, he was invariably neat and tidy. In my experience, when I met him, he usually was pretty clean, pretty well dressed, and so on. I don't know, even in his untidiness, and the general sort of appearance of all of us, I don't think he appeared quite as bad as most of us. Maybe it was his height that gave him a bit of distinction.
You talked about him writing. What yes. times of the day would he write?
Well, I've known him when I've gone on guard duty early in the morning. We changed over about 5 in the morning, so very early, and I've gone out, and I've been amazed to see him sitting up writing. So he certainly started very early when he could. But I have noticed him at various times during the day. At the front, he would sit up against sandbags, for example, and write. And in the evening too, he would write in a sort of room that we had in the Grange, where sometimes we ate meals. More often than not, we ate them where we were on duty.
Do you know what type of things he was writing?
Well, he must have been writing Homage to Catalonia, the book. Some of it, the notes for that, he must have been. He also wrote articles on the Spanish situation, and probably some of them could have been the ones that the New Statesman didn't publish, because it didn't accord with the orthodox left view of Spain, which was to support the official view, which was the communist view. The Galanx's view with the publisher was also of that, and Galanx refused to publish his book on it. As a result, it was published by I've seen the man often, Warburg. It was Warburg had to publish it because Gelenk wouldn't.
Did Orwell seem to write quickly or laboriously?
Fairly quickly, I would say. Yes, he seemed to write rather than think, you know. The pen was going, so he probably was one of these fortunate chaps that could write as he thought.
Did he ever discuss politics with you?
Oh, yes, he did. And we used to hammer out this question of the war and the revolution and the relationship between the two, and how far justified one was in not pursuing revolutionary aims when the defence and the future of Spain was concerned, and also the impossibility of getting people to give up what they had already accomplished.
What kind of line did he take? Did he agree with you or disagree?
Yes, we had much the same line. We differed from the others in that we weren't anti-communist in that sense that most people that held and supported the revolution, he used to say, and the communists are wrong in trying to always put the war first and never mind the achievements. And they would make a point of hammering that home. Whereas the communists, of course, partly asked for this by suggesting that everybody else was wrong because they wouldn't put the war first.
Did you discuss any other subjects with him besides politics?
Oh, yes, we did. It was mainly politics. I mean, we both wanted to join the International Brigade. George actually volunteered for it and made himself got quite fierce with Bob Edwards over it. Bob didn't think that we should. But yes, we certainly discussed other things. He asked me once whether I remembered the Eton boating song, and so I whistled and hummed and sang scraps of words of the thing, which is very strange because he wasn't a music chap, and he wasn't, normally interested in it. And I suppose that the words and the song had some meaning for him because he seemed to at least have some pleasant memories of Eton. He was a contemporary there with John Strachey and Oswald Mosley, of all people.
Why did he want you to recollect the Eton boating?
I think because he liked the association. It must have been. I mean, he never asked me to do it with the red flag or the international or. So I suppose that didn't have much meaning, but when they were at at Eton, I suppose the boating song must have come up and been sung a few times, and he rather liked the memory of it.
But why you? Because
I happen to know the thing. I happen to know the tune and the words. And he said, "Could you sing this? Some of the words, and could you remember the tune and all that?" We were on guard duty at the time together, so you talk about something. I suppose we'd had exhausted politics or got fed up with it or something, so we somehow got around to Eton and the boating song, and he couldn't recall it. He wasn't very musical, but he seemed pleased at the idea of it being repeated.
So he was just feeling nostalgic, was he?
I suppose so, yes. Unusual, because he wasn't, he was nostalgic about English things like toast and marmalade. Or he could recapture sort of English things with a few words that you knew exactly when he talked about little cafes in Soho and you could get olives and things like that there, which was quite different from Spain. He did have, in some ways, nostalgia for certain aspects of English life.
Did he seem sad or happy in Spain?
I think, personally, he seemed quite happy. Yes, I think so. He was always a bit cynical in his humour, and yet it didn't seem a personal sort of cynicism.
Can you give an example?
Oh, yes. When he was saying about journalists, you didn't have to have any ability to write. You just had to be capable of putting another person's work over in a different sort of way that somebody wanted, you know. And he says this in quite a tolerant way. He didn't blame anyone for doing it, but it just wasn't writing, you know, as he said, because he had very high standards in this. I mean, he wanted to turn the essay into sort of political criticism, which most writers don't aspire to that sort of thing at all. It's just a view of their own way of looking at things, and not really something which is deep enough to concern, you know, and influence political levels. I think in some ways he was an instinctive political thinker without being involved in the partisan political events. He was, for example, for a while a member of the ILP, and I remember he left it, well, just beginning of the war. I think he was unhappy about the ILP's attitude to the war, and he was quite happy to be associated with the ILP in Spain because they had it about right. But when it came to not doing anything about the Hitler thing, I think he felt that you know, it was time to part company. I didn't. I stayed in the ILP, oddly enough, right the way through the war, because I didn't see any point in leaving it. They were right about the war in their own, from their own point of view, that only the working class really paid the main penalty for the war, through some of the upper class people became involved. But it was the ordinary bloke that had nothing at all to do with it that is constantly put in the front line. And the ILP opposed it from that point of view. And that is that's quite a reasonable point of view, which it obtains in many war situations. But I think you have to go deeper than that and consider the political consequences of the result. And if you think that the political consequences of a defeat are too serious, then I think you ought to do something about it and take part in the war.
Coming back to Orwell, you've talked about the his concern about the treatment of animals in Spain.
Yes.
Was there anything else that irked him in Spain?
Yeah, I think he resented the tendency to argue about everything that needed doing. You know, at the front, for example, whatever you suggested was good for a long chatter, and I think he sort of thought, oh well, here we go again, sort of thing. But again, good humouredly, And this Spanish manana thing, you know, when are we going to get some decent ammunition, for example? The best ammunition was German ammunition. Mexican wasn't bad, the Spanish was terrible, always jamming and everything. So we had this indent in to get some decent ammunition, and it was always, tomorrow you're going to get it, yeah, tomorrow, that sort of thing.
When you say that he got impatient with the discussions about everything,
yes,
was this all part and parcel of the business of not having a strict discipline?
Yes, I think so. I think it was. Yes, I think it came from the fact that he knew that things could be ordered much better, much tidier, and that people would be happier, and that we wouldn't get these self-mutilating incidents with rifles because people weren't trained to say... I mean, I've known him look at one chap's rifle and say, look, this is more dangerous to you than it is to the enemy, sort of thing. And he knew enough about that, presumably because of his OTC training. Whereas, ignorance is bliss, I suppose. A lot of us didn't particularly realise that. We thought, well, at least it's pointing over there. It's not likely to come back at us. But some of them did. I think he's written somewhere that the first few casualties that he experienced, that he came across, were self-inflicted wounds.
Did you like him?
Oh, yes. Yes, I maintained contact with him after Spain, and I like him as a writer anyway. I think he's a sort of practical writer. When he writes about Down and Out in London and Paris, he did experience being down and out in both places. So he was qualified to write about it in a meaningful sense. It wasn't just something that he wrote in a Hampstead sort of cushy sitting room or something like that. He really felt it, and I remember discussing starving with him, or going hungry, sort of thing. And he said, one of the first things you get is a multiplicity of saliva. You go through a period where you get nothing but saliva. And, because I've never experienced it myself, but I thought, yeah, you must have been hungry to pick up a thing like that.
You talked about the way in which both of you, I think you said, wanted to join the International Brigade.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Why did both of you want to join?
Oh, because with all the political suspicion and hostility we had of their methods and so on, we recognised that's where the fighting was. And that was the place under attack, and that we had the moral or comradely responsibility to do our best to help them in that regard, because here we were on the Aragon front with very little happening, just occasional fire. You saw the enemy miles over there as a little moving dot on the landscape. You only had sporadic little outbursts, and you didn't really feel that you were making a useful contribution in the Spanish War. Whereas we thought that if we went to Madrid, we would.
So, did Orwell say to you that he wanted to join the International Brigade for these reasons?
Well, not about for these reasons. He certainly wanted to. It wasn't so much the International Brigade, although that was the inevitable thing. It was Madrid, to get to Madrid. We felt that Madrid was being attacked, and that here we were, and why couldn't we be there at least helping these people? But he certainly applied to Bob Edwards and Bob gave him reasons for not why he shouldn't go.
What reasons did Bob Edwards give?
I don't really recall them.
Did you hear them?
They're on record. It's on record. I think it's in homage to Catalonia. But certainly, Bob justified. He justified the decision. It could well have been the political instability of the situation. You see, it's hard really to recapture the meaningful atmosphere at the time. But there was a lot going on in the International Brigade, which was described by people like Fred Copeman later, which we didn't know about. And you see things simpler than they really are. We could very well have become the victims of some other plot if we had gone. You see, there was an uprising in Barcelona in May, on May the 3rd, 1937, where the business of the war or the revolution came to a head in that the communists had decided that the telephone building, which was in the hands of the ordinary anarcho-syndicalist workers, had to be taken and used and directed by themselves. So on May the 3rd, they sent an armed party led by a man called Rod de Gruys Salas to take the building. The fighting lasted 3 days before finally they took it. This became, people took sides during that time. The PUM took the side of the resistors. They took the same side as the trade unionists and the anarchists, that the attack on the building should be resisted. PUM headquarters wasn't very far from the building. And all the shops and the roofs of the houses were defended, if that's the word, by anarcho-syndicalists and PUM, and those of us in the ILP contingent that were on leave in Barcelona at the time. I remember I was given some phosphorus bombs to defend, that is to say, if anybody attacked, hurl one of these things at them. I don't know if you're familiar with these phosphorus bombs, but they have a sort of thing on them that you strike like a match. They're not held down by a lever. You strike the thing and throw it. And I left them in the corner because they're very sort of suspicious things. I think, what are they? They're the funny word for them. Indifferent bombs or non... in other words, they would blow up the chap that threw it just as readily as they, as to whom it was thrown. You had to get rid of them really quickly, apparently. Fortunately, the building was never attacked. It was all stuck to the telephone building. They never got down to the PUM headquarters in the Ramblers. So this was the sort of thing that really brought the revolution versus the war argument to a head for us at that time. You had to take a side. You were either with the communists taking the building away from the trade unionists and the anarcho-syndicalists, or not. You were on the side of helping the the telephone people, which was our position. Well, now, this got back to the International Brigade. What on earth happening in Barcelona? Here we are, fighting the enemy, and we get rumours of all this sort of thing in Barcelona. Well, it was bad for morale of the International Brigade, as you may very well imagine. They sent a chap called Tapsell, Walter Tapsell. A nice chap, everyone called him Tappy. And he spoke to John McNair and myself, and he asked us a lot of questions about May Day, what we saw and what we did and who we were with and our opinions about it. And we thought, well, he's a communist and he's been sent by the International Brigade, and the International Brigade and the communists were blaming Poom for this uprising. He'll not have very much alternative than to say that that's what happened. But surprisingly, he said to us, he believed us, that it was merely a response to an attack on the telephone building. He didn't believe there was an uprising. He had spoken to the chaps that were in charge of transport, and it wouldn't have been possible for them, in his opinion, to have moved tanks and guns around Barcelona without the communist-controlled trade unions being involved. So therefore, he exonerated Poom and said, his actual words, I think, Poom was being used as a blind, and that the Spanish Communist Party, and I think his actual words were not without knowledge or not without responsibility, something like that. Well, we never saw the report because it was given in to the International Brigade and not published, because it came to the conclusion that they didn't want anyway, so it was just shelved. Now, I would never have known anything more about this, because I never saw Tappy again. He was killed during the war, until I read Fred Copeman's book, when he talks about Tapping's unpublished report about the events of Barcelona. And to my utter astonishment, he's an honest communist. He wrote what he told us he believed, and because it didn't fit in with their sort of idea and the report couldn't be used, they simply filed it and forgot about it.